From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, we consider the so-called skills gap between workers and manufacturing jobs. Then, why a Dictionary of American Regional English is important.
Language is very much a reflection of who we are. It tells about where our families have come from, what people have created our communities, what effects we've endured in our living.
Writer Michael Perry explains what draws him to the wisdom of a friend and neighbor. And Melinda Myers wants you to slow down and really enjoy the sensual side of gardening.
I think we often rush through life and, oh, that's pretty, and you go to the next garden area. But if it's something that brushes against your leg or you touch the soft lamb's ear, you release fragrance when you touch the plant, it really is a different way to experience the landscape.
Stay tuned for Lake Effect on WUWM right after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. We've been hearing about the skills gap in manufacturing for a long time. In fact, one of WUWM's Project Milwaukee series focused an entire week of local programming on the topic last November. The skills gap argument asserts that manufacturing has plenty of job openings, but not enough qualified labor to fill them. But how true is that statement? Is it actually just a labor shortage? Or perhaps employers are being too picky, given that there are many unemployed manufacturing workers in the area who were laid off from the massive downsizing and relocation of much of the manufacturing sector? Milwaukee Magazine's contributing editor Eric Gunn took on this issue in his article Mind the Gap, which is in the current issue of the magazine. Gunn spoke to manufacturing managers, academics, workers, and researchers to try to determine whether there's actually a skills gap and also to examine the more nuanced nature of employment in the manufacturing sector. Gunn spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon, and he began with his impression of who is right.
I think each viewpoint has some elements of truth to it. I think that each side has also sort of a limited vantage point and as a result has some perhaps difficulty in really kind of understanding where the other side is coming from, so to speak.
Okay. I mean, it seems like they can't even decide on terminology, like just even agreeing on what a skills gap actually is. Or are they talking about a skills gap versus a pay gap or a culture gap? There's a lot of things at play. So are these factors being lumped into the term skills gap when that actually may not be accurate?
Well, they certainly are being lumped together. And I think there's another thing that's happening, and that is in some of these discussions, two different things gets conflated. One is more or less a future forecast, and the other is a description of the current status quo. I think it is less a matter of dispute that somewhere down the road we may not have the degree of people with some specific trade skills, if you will, because people are not going into the kinds of either tech education or apprenticeship programs or whatever that impart those skills. The question where there's a greater dispute and a greater disagreement, I think, is the current situation and the conflicting views as to whether there are people out there with skills and just not willing to take jobs at the pay that is offered, or if there really aren't the people out there with those skills.
And if there are the people out there with the skills, and we all hear this anecdotally that there are people with decades of manufacturing experience and welding experience, and it would be good candidates to our eyes and ears, but they're mm-hmm. not getting work. So if you have all these people with skills and they're not getting it sounds like it's more of a labor shortage rather than a skills gap in some cases.
In some cases, and there probably needs to be even, you know, really more deep down research in terms of the in terms of figuring out what's really going on with somebody who has, you know, access to a lot more data. I think that there also perhaps, for instance, becomes questions about whether some of the forecasting models that are used, how accurate those are or not. That's really an area that goes beyond what our story tried to look at, but I think it's one of the things implied in some of the discrepancies that people that occur in various views of this issue.
I have kind of an overall larger thought as I read your article, and part of it was that I was just thinking this, and I have no data to back it up, but I was just in my mind, because I've lived here a while on and off, that the manufacturing sector has created its own problem, because it's almost a PR problem, because there have been so many layoffs, so much outsourcing of jobs to other parts of the world, other parts of the country, that it became kind of a poisonous thing for young people to now and then to choose to go into manufacturing, because the reputation as it being a place to you can have a job for life was trashed. So who can blame young people for wanting to go into it? Because there is no guarantee. It's a gamble in a way.
That is certainly one of the issues that came up repeatedly from the segments of the community that I talked to who questioned the business narrative, the employer narrative about a skills gap. It was exactly, you know, as you described it. Now, there's a sort of a couple of things there. One is there are certainly smaller manufacturers who to move overseas would be pretty difficult for them, so that they're perhaps not to be looked at in quite the same lens as, you know, certainly the very large companies that have done that over the last few decades. That's one point. And then another point is that we actually are beginning, at least in to some degree, to see some of that work come back for one reason or another. At the same time, we don't have – there's still just a very different overall environment which makes that kind of work somewhat less secure even than it seemed to be, you know, a few decades back.
Is there any evidence from any – because you talk to manufacturing leaders as well as academics or people that do research. Any evidence that the – reputation of manufacturing is recovered? I mean, and maybe I'm just overstating it, but that younger people, because as you mentioned as well, that college has kind of been a bill of goods that's been sold to people as it's going to raise them out of their middle class or lower class, but that really hasn't come to fruition for a lot of people as well. So it makes more sense to go into manufacturing if it's there. So is there any evidence that there's been a shift in perception?
Well, you know, I think there's anecdotal evidence. Certainly some of the tech ed teachers that I've talked to said, you know, yeah, there was a time not so long ago when parents were very skeptical. And now, you know, as they are considering the future of their high school age sons and daughters, and now they are beginning to be persuaded that perhaps some of that is changing. I think the other point that was made, one of the people that I interviewed made the quite salient point that certainly if you look at job insecurity over the last few decades, manufacturing has not been alone. It's really been increasingly across all segments of our economy. And so that it's not just a manufacturing kind of issue, manufacturing versus anybody else. But again, there are certainly manufacturing operations that are in Milwaukee that are growing or trying to grow, and in Wisconsin in general. The scale is still, though, I think, important to remember. As you know, one of the people that I quoted in the story said, you know, who's involved in training and placement said, you know, there was a time. There was a potential of thousands of people at a particular place, and now there are hundreds, and that skill level is sort of ratcheted up that they need to be able to demonstrate. So it's harder to get something at a sort of an entry level that gets people that pathway in.
And yes, I mean, you said that, of course, the labor market all across the board has had problems and unemployment, but specifically for manufacturing, they, whereas, you know, there seems to be no trouble into, or no trouble talking younger people into going to college because there's an expectation that they're going to get a job, even though that isn't always the case. But the manufacturing sector has kind of the opposite problem. They have to talk people into doing it. So that provides its own problem.
And I think people, I mean, this sort of gets pretty, it's a kind of a broad problem of human nature. It always takes us as societies a while to really realize how the world has changed or is changing around us. So even as maybe there are signs that today's manufacturing environment is different from yesterday's in all kinds of ways, it may take a while for that news to really fully sink into people.
Yeah, and there's so many parties involved that are not seeing eye to eye on what the problem actually even is, according to the players in your article. Yeah.
I think one of the most salient points made in all of this was from Jeff Joris at Manpower, who one of the ways in which, you know, you look back maybe 50 years, there was, you had all kinds of different institutions and parties, and they certainly didn't just all get along wonderfully, you know, whether it was schools and unions and companies and government, but there was more of a give and take. And now, as the increasing focus in the business sector is above everything else, is getting costs down, that tended to really sort of snap the threads that held that fairly delicate web together. And there isn't the kind of connection and interchange between these various segments of the society that there used to be. So what we have here is people trying to find ways to restore that, both some of the, you know, ways described in the story and maybe others that go beyond that.
Something I found interesting, and I've never really heard anyone talk about it until I just saw it in your article, which is the idea that, yeah, there manufacturers are saying there's a skills gap, but there's something else at play. And I used the term earlier, cultural gap, but the idea that they can't find people that have a good attendance record or can get along with their coworkers, those kinds of things, which are, they're intangibles in a way that you can't necessarily do some research and get hard numbers on. But that seems to be at play in a lot of hiring decisions.
That is. And I think there are a couple of things going on there. I mean, sometimes what these kinds of skills, if you will, are referred to as soft skills. And even some of the individuals that I talked to, you know, such as a fellow over at the AFL-CIO training and office, said he's skeptical about the depth of this sort of hard skills gap, acknowledges that there does seem to be a difference in terms of the so-called soft skills. And why that is really, I think, going to be a very, you know, a matter of sort of great dispute. Are people more independent? Are they less docile? Are they brought up less well? Are they more self-interested? I think how you see that is very much dependent on one's own perspective about human nature and about things. But nonetheless, there is this issue of, I think, different expectations today in terms of personal behavior, in terms of what's important, and in terms of the benefit of, you know, showing up on time or not, or calling in sick or not. And again, I think, you know, these are, again, very things that just really can vary depending on what your own life experience has been. For some people, there's also you know, on the issue of showing up or not, there's also some indication that there aren't sick days the way there used to be, or there's less tolerance for people calling in sick, or people are struggling with more problems in terms of, you know, family issues and stuff like that. I don't think it's, again, I think, like all of these, I don't think it's any, it's black and white in any respect from one perspective or another.
Something that I found really intriguing, kind of one of the overarching themes in what you wrote through various people, is the idea that even if there is a skills gap, and you can choose to believe it or not, depending on what data you read or choose to believe, but the idea that even if there is a skills gap, that still is a shortage. And for all of us that have taken basic economics, when there's a shortage in the labor market, generally wages are reflected in that, and you try to pay people more to get that shortage filled. So, and even though what's going on in South Dakota and Wyoming with the oil boom, and they're paying people a lot of money to move to where these jobs are. So why is that not a strategy here to get people to move to Wisconsin if there actually is a skills gap here, and pay them more money to move here?
Well, and that's certainly one of the issues. That's certainly one of the issues that the skeptics have raised. On the other hand, I've talked to other folks, you know, people in those hiring positions who insisted that it was just a matter of the sheer numbers of applicants that they got. Now, without access to sort of every single individual that they interviewed, there's a limit to how much we can really understand as to what's going on there in terms of why these employers report that experience. But, you know, as one fellow said to me, I could offer $10 an hour more and I still wouldn't find the people.
Has he tried offering $10 more an hour to find people? Has anyone tried it?
Yep, that's them.
Yeah, okay. Well, just as a follow-up to the idea that if there's a shortage, you know, pay people to move to where the jobs are, if those jobs are here. So is there any evidence that, well, first of all, I know so many people that have left the state of Wisconsin in the past, I don't know, 10 to 15 years, and that's just my group of friends and people that I know. It seems to me that I'm not alone, that people have left, you know, that they're, where have all these people that have been laid off of manufacturing jobs in the past, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years, where have they gone? I mean, are they still around? Have they moved on to other fields?
A lot of them are still around here and have moved on to other things that pay less. You know, others have, you know, moved. I think their ability to move it has in part depended upon their, what kind of skills they got laid off with in the first place and what skills and credentials they got laid off with in the first place. And, you know, probably some of them, if they were skilled welders, are now the folks that are out in North Dakota or Wyoming or, you know, other places where those jobs have been in demand. As I say, and again, other people have, you know, moved into different fields in some element of this, of the what's sort of loosely grouped together as the service sector, whether it be healthcare or retail or that sort of thing, and probably paying less. And other people have made, have then gone on to get a degree and moved into things like teaching or social service work or any number of things. There's sort of no one path that everybody has sort of taken out of that.
As a wrap up here, after all the people you talked to write this article, are you convinced that there is a skills gap or that there isn't, or are you still thinking it's a gray area?
Well, I think it is a pretty gray area. I mean, I think that both the, you know, as I really sort of suggest in the story, that each of these sort of differing perspectives, people having each of these conflicting perspectives, really need to sit down and pay attention to what the conflicting people with the conflicting perspectives are saying and give that some consideration. There's not just sort of any neat, simple answer to this problem. And I think that's the point that Jeff Joris at Manpower makes. And one of the reasons that I wanted to make sure that that perspective was reflected in the story, is that there really needs to be a greater degree of interchange of information and collaboration on these problems from these differing perspectives in order to really make sense of it all and to begin to resolve the problem, however the problem is ultimately defined, as a skills gap or a jobs gap or something of both.
All right, Eric Gunn, thank you very much. That's a very compelling piece of writing. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Eric Gunn is a contributing editor at Milwaukee Magazine, and he wrote the article Mind the Gap, which is in the current issue. There's a link to it from WUWM.com/Lake Effect, and there is also a link there to WUWM's Help Wanted series from last November as well. English may be the official language of the United States, but regional differences in words and phrases can make it seem we're not all speaking the same tongue. We'll learn about a dictionary that tracks regional American English when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. If you've celebrated a golden birthday, played sheep's head, or directed a thirsty friend to the bubbler, you're probably a cheesehead. The Dictionary of American Regional English chronicles these Badger State terms, as well as colloquialisms from the rest of the country. The DARE staff works out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Chief Editor Joan Houston Hall spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley and began by explaining which words are DARE material.
It's a reference book that attempts to include words and phrases and pronunciations and even bits of grammar and syntax that vary from one part of the country to another. So, your listeners will be familiar with the bubbler, of course, and we all know that not everybody calls a drinking fountain a bubbler. But those are the things that we include in DARE, the words and phrases that people might not recognize everywhere.
Why is it important to chronicle regional language, and how did that viewpoint lead to the creation of DARE?
Well, it's important because our language is very much a reflection of who we are. It tells about where our families have come from, what people have created our communities, what effects we've endured in our living, and it varies from place to place. So it's an integral part of our history of Americans. And the notion of a dictionary of the speech of Americans has been around for a very long time. The idea was first proposed in 1889 when the American Dialect Society was founded. What the people who were in the society wanted to do was to make a dictionary of American English that would be similar to the dictionary of English dialects that was being created in England at the time. But of course, our country is so much bigger, they knew it would take very much longer. And of course, it did. We've just published the 6th volume of DARE, and that takes us not only from A to Z, but also includes a volume of supplementary materials. So we have come a long way since 1889, and we're now working on the digital edition, which should make it very much more widely available.
What are some Wisconsin terms, maybe from the north or the west, that people here in southeast Wisconsin might not know?
Well, it's sometimes difficult to distinguish within a state very accurately, but one of the things that I think is more westerly Wisconsin than easterly is the phrase, oh, that's a horse apiece, if you want to say it's 6 of one or half a dozen of the other. And that comes from a dice game called horse. Of course, the bubbler is much more common in southeastern Wisconsin than in the rest of the state. Other things that vary from one area to another are things like the term lawyer for a fish. You might say, oh man, let's go have some lawyers tonight. If you did that, you'd be likely to be up in Door County or somewhere along the Great Lakes. Because lawyer is a name for a fish, which is also called a freshwater cod or a ling, or a burbot, or many other names as well.
Any other terms that might not be familiar to people in this area of the state, but that would be elsewhere?
Well, I don't know what you call the strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street in Milwaukee, but in Madison, the official term is the terrace. So the newspaper will say, put your garbage cans out on the terrace on Thursday morning, or something like that. But that's a really interesting term, because we discovered in doing the field work for DEER that there are probably a couple of dozen terms for that particular cultural item. So in various parts of the country, it can be the parking strip, the parkway, the berm, the boulevard, the tree lawn, the terrace, the verge, the swale, all sorts of names. What do you call it in Milwaukee?
I'm not really sure. Maybe the strip of grass in the middle.
No, I didn't have a term for it growing up, because where I lived, we didn't even have that sort of thing. So it's culturally affected, of course.
People listening right now might have some of the best known Wisconsin terms running through their heads. What are some of the words that most natives here could list off to you?
Oh, well, things like, I'm going out to get some bakery. Would you like some? When I first heard that, I thought, how strange. I thought a bakery was a place where you bought pastries. I didn't realize it could be the pastries themselves. Or go 6 blocks to the stop and go and then turn left. Well, to me, that would mean go 6 blocks to a commercial establishment called the stop and go, not to a stoplight.
Ah.
Or if you say, I'm going by John's, does that mean you're going to drive on by, or does it mean you're going to stop there? In places where there's German influence, it means that you're going to stop there, because it's from the German B-E-I rather than the English B-Y. And there are things like squeaky cheese, of course, which is common to everybody here, but I had never heard of it before moving to Wisconsin. Milwaukee area also has Spanish hamburger for a sloppy Joe. And Wisconsinites all know about flowages. But people in the rest of the country would have no idea what a flowage was.
Wait, I don't know what a flowage is. I'm from Michigan.
Oh, well, you're probably not a canoeist then. There are lots of flowages up in the Northwest where streams have been dammed or constricted somehow to make lakes, and you can canoe on the flowage. It's like an artificial
lake.
And, of course, card games, sheep's head, Schafskopf. Those are both very Wisconsin terms. And Scott also as a card game. The tradition of the golden birthday is a very Wisconsin thing. Are you familiar with that one?
I've heard of it once or twice, yeah.
Yeah, your golden birthday is the birthday that matches the day of the month on which you were born. So I was born on the 21st of July, so my golden birthday was when I turned 21. But that's the kind of thing that you can talk about in another part of the country, and people will have absolutely no idea what you mean. So it's nice that it's a tightly regional kind of term. Or there are things like beeler for a mischievous child, or if kids are standing in line and somebody wants to get ahead of others, they'll say, no budging. That's a very Wisconsin thing, too, as opposed to no butting in or no cutting. Or things like, I'm going to the store, want to come with? In other parts of the country, people will be kind of waiting for you to finish the sentence. You want to come with me? But here, where there's lots of influence, not just from German, but from other languages as well, Dutch, Danish, Frisian, Norwegian, all those languages have a construction like the German mitgehen, which means go with. And so it's okay in those languages to say, want to come with. There are lots of regional terms in Wisconsin that are based on the ethnic traditions of our ancestors, too. Of course, we all know about lutefisk, whether we eat it or not, and lefse, and krumkaka, and limpa, and pierogies, and sandbakels, and kielbasa, and kolachki. All these reflect the backgrounds of our families.
Nationwide, what are some of the most comical terms that you've encountered, or terms that might be comical to us here, but maybe not to people living there?
Oh, well, one of my favorites is the way people refer to somebody they think is really stupid. So you could say, he doesn't have sense enough to carry guts to a bear, or he doesn't have sense enough to bell a buzzard. That's in the South Atlantic. But my very favorite is one where people just embellish a phrase till it's really quite amazing. So people have fun with language, and sometimes it's at the expense of others, but that's part of our language. And I think in times when we were less literate and less dependent on schooling, colorful phrases and ways of speaking allowed people to remember things that they might not remember if they couldn't read. So the folk language is very much a part of our cultural heritage, and we've got lots and lots of really colorful phrases.
So using regional terminology, how could we end this interview by saying thank you and goodbye?
Well, we might say ufta, which is an all-purpose expression, a Norwegian phrase that can be expressing surprise or aversion or disgust or, I think, even pleasure. So thank you very much.
Ufta, then. Well, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for being on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Joan Houston Hall edits the Dictionary of American Regional English, which is based at UW-Madison since 1963. Houston Hall spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley. To test your knowledge of regional terminology, check out the DARE quizzes. A link to them is found at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a short break, and then coming up next, writer Michael Perry shares the wisdom he's absorbed from a friend and neighbor in his newest book, and with us, next on Lake Effect. You're listening to WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect from WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. From birth, our lives are shaped by the people who share their wisdom, either as spoken advice or just by example in the way they live. We readily absorb that wisdom when we're young, but often it seems that we're less apt to look for that wisdom as we, ourselves, get older. But that's not always the case. Wisconsin writer Michael Perry found himself learning some things about machinery and some things about life as he got to know his friend and neighbor, 82-year-old Tom Hartwig. The time he and his family have spent with Tom forms the backbone of Perry's latest book, which is appropriately called Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. The book is just out now in paperback, so we thought it a perfect time to revisit the interview Mitch Tyke did with Mike Perry last August, when the book first came out. Perry began then by explaining why he was drawn to people like Tom Hartwig.
Well, in part because Tom's what I call a roughneck polymath. He can do just about everything. He did graduate from high school in the 40s, but he's pretty much a self-taught guy. And it isn't that those type of people are disappearing, but I think people who possess a breadth of knowledge are disappearing. We're all becoming very specific in our knowledge. And so that attracted me. The biggest thing that attracted me was I wanted to write a book about what you can learn from your neighbor by just being neighbors. And I've gone out of my way to point out that this is not a book about me choosing a mentor, or I have no special claim on him. Many folks know him better than I do. But I just want to see what can you pick up over the course of a year just running over to see him to get some rebar bent, cut, or welded. And there is a family connection in that my wife worked for him when she was a young girl. She was on his hay crew, and she told me he told me that she outworked every boy he ever hired. And the line I use is, I realized later that was less a statement about her character than a challenge to my own.
Well, and it strikes me that again, the Tom Hartwigs of the world, the roughneck polymaths, do not necessarily go out of their way to call attention to themselves. So they are both unheralded and disappearing.
That's part of it too, and I'm glad you brought it up because it reminds me to mention also that this isn't a book about Tom. It's a book about all the Toms out there and the female versions as well. His wife is he says in the book, I'd be nowhere without my wife. And what I like about what you've just brought up is that, yes, I'm writing about a very specific guy, his very specific stories, but already I'm just a few days into the tour and the number of people who have come up and said, oh, I know a guy just like that. And that makes me feel good because that's what I'm trying to do. These guys, these characters are in Mississippi, California, New York State, wherever you go.
But I also can't help but think in reading about Tom specifically that he does not seem like the kind of person who would necessarily embrace the idea of a book being written, if not about him, about his archetype.
No. As a matter of fact, I asked his permission to write the book since he's my neighbor first and the subject second. He gave me permission, but he insisted that I change his name, and I thought that was fair enough, and I've changed a couple of identifying details. Of course, the flip side is if you read about him, you realize that he is such a character that anybody within about 50-mile radius, of course, knows who he is. But yeah, I think he definitely – I had second thoughts about it, and even now I wonder, I hope that I haven't opened his life up to something unwanted. On the other hand, I just – I wanted to honor the guy, and I wanted to honor people like him. And I also, he's got some great stories. Wanted to tell him.
One of the things that you write about, it's not just you that's visiting Tom through this. It's you and your family. Why is it important for you that your children have this memory of visiting with Tom and Arlene?
I've benefited so much from having these bridges to the past that my parents set up in taking me to visit the old Norwegian neighbors who lived up the road. The woman my parents bought the farm from, she actually would tell us about coming to the country in a buckboard. I had another neighbor who remembered trading with Native Americans. And so here I am in 2012, 47 years old, and yet I have a tangible connection to almost pre, quote unquote, civilized times. And now my children know Tom, and he talks about driving oxen, and he talks about when his relatives came to the country. And he's also taught my children the history of the Ojibwa in that area, because he used to go down to the stream and find their camps, and he would explain why they camped on one side of the creek versus the other. And so to me, it's just nice for them to see someone who can take them back in time that far and give them a sense of the scope of history right in their own backyard.
And it's funny because the title of the book is Visiting Tom, but the thing that you do and the thing that you do with your children is really visiting with him as opposed to just visiting him.
Right, because as I point out in the book, one of the things I get a kick out of with Tom and folks like him, if you look him right in the eye and ask him for wisdom, he's just going to run you around. You know, there's a scene where he has two daughters also, and so I have two daughters, and I thought, well, I'll ask this 80-year-old father of two daughters, what can you tell me about raising daughters? And his answers were almost all nearly unprintable. I included a couple, but and yet if you just hang out with him, if you just go over and get your brush hog welded, or if you bring over some pork chops and have dinner with him, in the course of natural conversation, you'll learn limitless things. But no, he doesn't respond well to interrogatories, as they say.
Well, and one of the limitless things that you learn is if you're going to give him pork chops, you ought to remember to bring the pork chops with you.
If you promise to pay for your welding with pork chops, it's really critical to remember to bring the pork chops because he will put you through the emotional ringer. Even as he tells you he trusts you, he still gets his pound of flesh, as it were.
We should mention, because this part gets a lot of attention and maybe disproportionately so, but among his hobbies is the art of building working artillery, cannons that yes, that occasionally stand out in his yard and that he uses.
Yes. He builds and shoots his own cannons, and he has a cannon that he keeps in a shed, and it points across his driveway. You have to drive not only past the cannon but before it, as I say, and look at the menacing hollow. Eye. He never keeps it loaded, but it's there. And yeah, that, of course, I ain't going to lie to you. I brought that up in some of the promotional material because it's fun. And if you go to my website, we've got video of him shooting it, and it's pretty spectacular. But it's also – it speaks to the kind of guy he is and the kind of people that I was raised by. And again, I'm including the women in this too, that there was this roughneck sense of humor. So here he's got all these skills. He uses his lathe, which he's proud to point out. The most recent patent on it is a 1918. Patent. And yet he uses that lathe to – I've been there while he turns out parts for guys' $350,000 combines. And yet he also uses that lathe to make cannons because he likes to shoot them. And I like that sort of underlying sense of humor that folks like this have. So if you ask him, what on earth are you making cannons for? Well, because I can and because I want to. And he also, he's a history buff, and he'll talk about the history of cannons. But mostly, he just likes to make it go boom.
There's an underlying sense of mischief.
There is. Yep, you bet. And that's the kind of thing, too, that ultimately the book is about equanimity. We haven't mentioned it yet, but his – he lived in this very beautiful, secluded spot with a creek running through the yard. And the interstate came through his yard when he was a man in about his 30s and split his world in two and dumps 8 million vehicles a year past his front yard. And part of what I'm looking for from Tom for my own benefit, because goodness knows I need it, is how do you develop what I think is a sense of equanimity? How do you face something like 22,000 vehicles a day through his yard and yet – And believe me, he's grumpy about that, and he talks about that in the book. But he has then gone on to live a full and engaged life and shoots his cannons, and that sense of humor is part of it, obviously.
Mike Perry, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Michael Perry's latest book is called Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and The Road to Roughneck Grace. It's published by Harper, and it's just out now in paperback. Mitch Teich's interview with Perry first aired last year. We will take one last break and then catch up with contributor and gardening expert Melinda Myers, who's again out in West Allis, talking gardening for the duration of the state fair. Stay tuned. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Cream puffs, deep-fried Oreos, foods that usually require a plate served on a stick. Well, yes, it's that time of year, State Fair. The fair has just about everything you could want, from delicious Wisconsin foods to racing pigs, show horses and product hawkers and great concerts. Oh, yes, and it's Garden Oasis. Well, if that last one threw you, then you likely haven't visited We Energy's Energy Park, where gardening expert and Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers has created yet another beautiful and informative display. Myers can be found at the fair every day, giving a talk once in the morning at 9:45 and again in the afternoon at 2. She's our gardening contributor as well, and she tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce what patrons can expect during this year's presentations.
You know, every year I'm lucky enough to be at We Energy Energy Park, and so coming up with something new and different to get people excited about gardening and energy conservation, we're doing Follow Your Five Senses to Energy Savings and a Beautiful Landscape. So we are looking for different ways for you to take advantage of all your senses in the garden.
And see, that's interesting because usually people think of, oh, I want it to look pretty. I want it to be appealing to my eyes. But we don't often think about using the other senses.
Exactly. Fragrance might be not too far of a stretch, but still, it's one that we don't always plan into the landscape. So we've got fragrant bloomerang lilac, which is a repeat blooming lilac. We have some scented geranium, so you give them a pet, and that's wonderful. Heliotrope, which attract butterflies and hummingbirds. Beautiful purple flowers and a wonderful vanilla licorice fragrance as well, and some nicotiana. So for those evening fairgoers, they'll get a whiff of those as well. So we've built in some fragrance. So not a hard stretch, but still something we often overlook because that can be really effective in your garden.
Now, how exactly do you incorporate sound into your garden other than maybe flapping butterfly wings?
Really loud, yeah. Flying butterflies and bats eating the mosquitoes. Great question. Rustling of grasses in the wind, which sometimes in January may not be as enticing as it is on a hot summer day. We've got some beautiful wind chimes that'll just kind of add a little sound. The buzzing of bees. Not bad. You know, we also, people worry about bees, but really they're more busy nectaring on the plants. And it's only when we get in their space and trap them that there's a problem. So sound is a little more challenging. Water features that help block out the sound of maybe the traffic in your neighborhood or the neighbor that might be a little louder than you like. And we talk about screening. We have screenings for view and sounds you don't want to hear, and then using sounds you prefer to block those noises you are kind of trying to mask.
Sounds like making for a very tranquil garden.
Exactly. And that's kind of what we look at We Energy, and that's what I hear when the people come to Energy Park. They really say, this is kind of a little oasis in the fair. The fair is wonderful, but it's full of energy and blacktop and noise and food and all of that. And then you come to our space. The temperature's cooler because just adding plants to your landscape and that space can reduce energy, the heat by about 15 degrees.
Wow.
So a lot cooler. We conserve water because we have so much green space. When we have a heavy rain, there's not puddles. It's going through the ground into the groundwater. So we do that. We capture it with rain barrels and rain gardens. And we have a wonderful rain chain, too, that adds some nice element to that as well.
Now, certainly reducing the temperature goes along with the sensation of touch and feel, but how else do we incorporate that sense in the garden?
You know, I think we think of children when we think of soft, fuzzy lamb's ear or prickly cactus that you may not want to give a hug. Or again, the scented geraniums that release the smell. We've also got buttered popcorn plants. So touch is something we don't think of, but the texture that we look at, when you start touching it, you can feel that difference. So I've been lucky enough to do some horticulture work with people who have limitations with vision, and texture is really what they use to embrace the garden. And it's a neat way to look, the texture of bark, when you feel that coarse texture of bark, a big old bur oak that you can stick your arm in the furrow of the bark of the tree, gives you that sense of power. You know, when the grass sways, it not only adds sound and motion, but you can feel that going through your fingers. And so it's a new way to experience the garden, because I think we often rush through life and, oh, that's pretty, and you go to the next garden area. But if it's something that brushes against your leg, or you touch the soft lamb's ear, or, you know, some of those things, the artemisia, or you release fragrance when you touch the plant, it really is a different way to experience the landscape.
What about taste? I don't know that we're going around eating flowers.
Well, we don't want you to eat our flowers, but we do have some edible flowers like calendula, also called pot marigold. And it gets the name because they used it to season stews and soups that you would cook in a pot. And it's yellow or orange like a marigold, so it's pot marigold. We have lots of herbs, so Chef Mark, who does cooking demonstrations, will be harvesting herbs right from the garden to put in there. And, of course, we mix in tomatoes and peppers and eggplants in with our ornamentals, because we want you to know that even if you have a small city lot, or maybe you have a large garden but don't want a huge vegetable garden, a couple of strategically placed vegetable plants or fruits. We have a little raspberry shortcake that was loaded with raspberries a week ago. So there are ways to incorporate those in your ornamental garden to get vegetables and fruit that maybe you just walk out your back door, pluck, bring them into the kitchen and cook.
Nice. Now, how do the energy savings get incorporated into these gardens? We talked a little bit about the water savings, but what about energy?
Well, and one, if you grow your own food, food travels something like 1,575 miles to get from the farm to our refrigerator. So if you grow your own and harvest your own, that's going to reduce energy costs that way. Talked about having ground covers, reducing the heat. Shading. We have a few shade trees that will not interfere with utility lines. And talk about shading your east and west side of your house, the windows, greatly reduces your energy cost in cooling. And shading the roof of your house, the attic, will also help lower that temperature by 10 degrees or more, which means less money spent. Windbreaks, so putting plantings so that you break the winds, reduces your heating cost in winter. So strategically placing plants, and then we have our green roof doghouse. So obviously not all of us can change our roof into a green roof, but that's really a trend that not only reduces replacement needs on the roof once they install, but reduces heating and cooling costs, and it filters the water. So we're putting less water in the storm sewer. So we're not doing it on a large scale, but there might be places like, instead of a canvas awning, maybe you make a wood structure with a green roof. If you have a doghouse, your dog will enjoy the beauty a little more. And we also have a fun green roof bird feeder just for fun and giggles, but just to show there are ways that even on a small scale, you can make a difference.
Next thing you know, we'll be putting green roofs on our jungle gyms.
That's
in the backyard.
True. And the kids, not a bad idea.
You're at the State Fair each year, and each year you're coming up with a unique idea to engage Wisconsinites, not only in the best ways to create a beautiful, functional garden, but also in ways to save and conserve energy. Why do you feel it's important for you to bring this message out?
Well, one is I love the opportunity to share what I've learned along the way, and this is a great forum to do it. And, you know, I really look at any little thing we can do as individuals to improve our backyard, our neighborhood, our community has a huge impact. You know, sometimes when you think about energy conservation, you're like, what can I do? I can't afford an electric car. I can't really make a big difference. Well, there are a lot of things you can do. Plant a rain garden so the water goes into the rain garden. Have a rain barrel. I like to use simple, easy techniques. We're all very busy. We all would like to do the right thing, but if we don't have time and if it's too hard, we're not going to do it, even though we intend to. So I really love this form because not only can I tell you, but I can show you. You know, I can show you things that are achievable on a small scale and a little bit larger scale. And every year I love to change it up because we all get bored. So try new and different things. We all keep learning along the way. So I'm lucky enough to see new ideas and trends as I travel the country, and I can bring them back here. And with the help of the Wisconsin Landscape Contractors, the commercial flower growers, other people who have donated product and materials, we can create this beautiful space thanks to We Energy and really have a nice forum to teach in a garden. And that's kind of the best of anything you can do as a teacher and a gardener is teach right in the garden.
So if people are looking for that little oasis in the middle of the state fair, where can we find the We Energy's Energy Park?
It's on 84th Street at Whitney. I think it's Whitney Way Road. So we're right on 84th and right next to usually where the fair food of the year is. The machine shed has the cream puff hamburger, the chocolate covered bacon. We're right next door. So I get to see the trends of the food. So we're right next door and I'm on at 9:45 and 2 o'clock every day giving a presentation and I stay and answer questions until everybody goes or they kick me off the stage.
Excellent. Well, Melinda Myers, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gardening expert and Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers will be giving talks at 9:45 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon each day of the State Fair on how to follow your five senses to energy savings and a beautiful landscape. It all takes place at We Energy's Energy Park. The award-winning Myers has written numerous books on gardening. She leads regular walks at Berner Botanical Gardens, and she has a new series of DVDs out on gardening called How to Grow Anything. You can find links to much more about her from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll do it again tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.